Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with the samples. I've been battling allergies for years now. Let me tell you, they've been a real ordeal in my life. Luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to ClaritinD.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's up, gang? Welcome to The Greatness Machine. I'm your host, Darius Mrshazadeh. I'm so pumped to have you here with me. Now listen, The Greatness Machine, we're about two things. Number one, people who are living their passions. And number two, those who are creating greatness in the world and doing both of these things despite the odds against them. Each episode, we're going to feature interviews with game changers, business leaders, you know, telling us their origin stories, what made them tick, what got them to where they are now. Why? So it can help you step into your greatness within your life, your business, and your career. Occasionally, you might hear a few solo episodes from myself, moi as I say, as I leverage my 20 years of entrepreneurship as a CEO and founder to help you grow and level up in your journey to scale your life and your business. So come be a fly on the wall, enjoy the conversation, and I'm stoked to have you here with me. So guys, welcome to The Greatness Machine. I'm your host, Darius Mrshazadeh. Boy, do we have a special guest for you today. My friend, Brent Gleason, is here to join us. Brent, welcome to the show.
What's up, Darius? How you doing, brother?
Oh, man. You know, just dealing with some technical difficulties and getting after it.
It happens.
So, guys, I got introduced to Brent from John Talinger, a friend of mine in the mortgage industry. And he said, oh, you know, he sees I talk to all sorts of folks for the show, as you guys know. And here at The Greatness Machine, we're about people who are living their passions to create greatness in the world. And he's like, you really have to interview Brent. And I was like, done. So without further ado, I want to go over a quick bio and then we'll get started with this conversation. So guys, Brent is, you are the first Navy SEAL to be on the show, which I'm really pumped about because the Navy SEALs are all about creating greatness in the world. And Brent is a Navy SEAL, combat veteran, serial entrepreneur, best-selling author. He's had two books. His most recent book, Embrace the Suck, we're going to be talking about that. And he's an acclaimed speaker on topics ranging from leadership and culture transformation to change management and building high-performance teams. So without further ado, my man Brent, welcome, my friend.
Thanks for having me on the show, man. Excited to be here.
Oh, man. I had this thing happen to me. So you want to hear a funny my funny Navy SEAL story?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, so like that. All right, I had a friend of mine. She's from she and I traveled the world together when we were in college, and she moved to San Diego from she grew up outside Scranton, Pennsylvania, and she ends up meeting these two guys who are Navy SEALs in her apartment complex, and we go out to PB in San, and I was living in Santa Barbara at the time, and I drove down to visit her. And like she and I kind of had like a little bit of a crush on each other in college, but like nothing really had happened. And so, that's such an awkward story. I've never told it before.
It's making me awkward already.
So I go down to PB and we just go out partying all night. Right. And we go out partying all night, and she, and the guy that lives downstairs with his Navy SEAL, her and the roommate come out, and we go and we hang out, and he's in the SEALs at this moment. And I sat there with him, and I probably talked to him for 4 hours. And I mean, I'm a type of person who will ask you every question. You know, he probably said I was classified to me like 18 times, you know, like he couldn't answer my questions, but he was cool. And I learned all about like buds and just all the training. And I mean, this is a conversation I had 21 years ago, and I still remember it being a really cool conversation. So, you know, one thing led to another, and I go back to her house, and me and my friend, we hook up that night, but nothing comes out of it. I end up like, you know, it's a college fling thing. And so long story short, I go to DC, I get a job at the White House, and I come home, my dad's dying, and I go and I come home, my father's passed away, and I go down to see her again because she's my friend. But at this point, she's living with the Navy SEAL. It's her boyfriend. Same dude, right? So this time he wasn't as friendly with me.
Right, I'm sure.
Like at all. And he's like cleaning his gun in front of me and like polishing grenades. And it was, I'm sitting there and I'm like, man, I mean, he wasn't like, you weren't dating her when I hooked up with her. It's like, come on, like, why are you being mean to me? Anyway, they ended up breaking up about a year later. But anyway, that was my first and only real interaction with the Navy SEAL.
Wow.
So, I didn't mean to make you feel awkward there, but I thought it was a funny story. So tell us, man.
Grenade polishing in my day as well. So.
Yeah, and whenever you want, whenever you're like jealous, just pull out, just start cleaning guns. That's the way to really show some authority. So, man, tell us, one of the things I love about the show is we do origin stories, and I'd love to hear your origin story. I mean, you, off the air, you were telling a little bit about, you know, what you did before you got in the SEALs, but maybe tell us, you know, you grew up in Dallas, Texas, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about, you know, where you're from, where, you know, how you got to where you got to, and I'd love to hear the origin story a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in Dallas, did my undergrad education at SMU, Southern Methodist University. At the time, no real aspirations for joining the military and certainly not the world of special operations. I'd read a couple books about, you know, the history of the SEAL teams and things like that, just for entertainment value. And so I graduated. I took a job as a financial analyst for a global firm based out of Dallas. Now, during that time, I had, you know, I grew up in a family of four. I've got a twin brother, just like you do, your fraternal twins. And my parents still live in Dallas. And so, you know, pretty normal, nice life in Dallas. And at SMU, I had a good friend of mine, one of my fraternity brothers, who was a year behind me in school. Now, he was, in fact, one of these young men who had more or less a lifelong dream and vision of one day graduating, joining the Navy, and at least attempting to be accepted into the notorious SEAL training pipeline. Now, this was just pre-9/11, so kind of obviously a different cultural environment when it comes to military service and the world of special operations. And he and I actually started training together. So for me, I'd been a college athlete. It was just a way to, you know, stay fit, have an accountability partner, but also prepare, you know, help him prepare for his arduous journey that lay before him. And so we started spending so much time together and having a lot of, you know, dialogue about the challenges and the risk involved in what he was embarking on. And so I started reading more books and reading about the history of the Naval Special Warfare community, from our forefathers in the underwater demolition teams in World War II to how we essentially cut our teeth as an elite assault force in Vietnam, and really became fascinated with, you know, the culture, you know, leadership, the environment that we create as an organization, as essentially a high-performing organization, and you know, the values, the behaviors, the rituals that are all designed to achieve a desired outcome on the battlefield. And long story short, that growing fascination coupled with the somewhat boring nature of my entry-level financial analyst position led to the culmination of a decision to be like, you know what, I'm gonna leave the spreadsheets and pivot tables behind for a little while. And, you know, I joined him on his radical journey of nautical nonsense. And interestingly, you know, went to Buds, came out here to San Diego, obviously. And the training pipeline is many, many months long. And it's broken into different segments. The first segment, for, I know you know this, but for those watching and listening, is called BUDS. Naturally, it's an acronym. It stands for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL. It's the first 6 months of a very long training pipeline. Typically, if you see anything in documentaries or movies, it's a depiction of some parts of BUDS and Hell Week and things like that. Well, we finished BUDS, and then we had a few days you know, off before we started advanced training, or SQT, SEAL qualification training.
Right.
That's when you really start to learn to hone your craft as a Naval Special Warfare operator. Well, 9/11 was one of those 3 days right between BUDS and SQT. So, you know, obviously immediate mindset transformation when it comes to the reality of, you know, of the world of military service for all branches and military organizations all over the world. So that was kind of an interesting part of that journey. And then obviously Afghanistan kicked off, and then by the time I was at my platoon and did our workup, we actually were some of the first SEALs in Iraq in April of 2003. So that's kind of a little bit of the backstory, and then we'll get into other stuff later on. But
so you sorry, that was that was a quick jump. so you went when you got into because you were training with a fraternity brother. And yeah. You made the decision to pull the trigger. Did you do OCS or did you go straight to Navy and say, I'm going to go into BUDS? Like, how does that even work?
Yeah. So we put officer packages together. So officer OCS, officer candidacy school. And ultimately we decided to enlist like a lot of guys do. It's more of a strategic decision because, basically it comes down to math and risk. You know, if you have, let's say, easy math, you have a class, we run 6 classes a year. So every couple of months we start a new BUDS class. Well, you're only going to have out of, let's say, 200 students, you're only going to have a small pocket of places for officers. So Naval Academy gets half of those, and then OCS and, you know, ROTC folks get the other half. So you have some risk there when it comes to not just being accepted because it's very competitive, but also getting into a class as soon as possible. We wanted to get two BUDS as fast as we possibly could. And so what a lot of guys do, and 75% of our enlisted SEALs have at minimum an undergrad degree already. Some have master's degrees.
Interesting.
And, a lot of guys spend more time in the, you know, in the professional world or the corporate world before coming in. And quite frankly, they have a little bit higher success rate, the older guys do, than the ones that are just right out of high school coming from mom and dad's house to BUDS.
Yeah. It's a little bit of a learning curve.
No life experience whatsoever. Now, granted, some are successful, and then you have a very young, experienced operator by the time they've, you know, done a couple of platoon cycles in the teams. So yeah, so we enlisted, and yeah, the plan worked well. Went, you know, 2 months of whatever it was, something like 2 months in Great Lakes at boot camp, and then did back then we would go to what's called an A school. It's basically learning a trade. So when you fail out of BUDS, you have a job.
so when you did, what percentage? What is? I used to know this number. But what percentage of people actually make it through SEAL, like to become a SEAL from start to like? What percentage is on average?
It varies class to class, but I mean it can be upwards of 10 to 15% success rate. So
wow,
very high. And if you think about it too, from start to finish, you have. I forget the exact numbers. You might have 1,000 people. If you broke up, okay, 6 classes a year, we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of, you know, of people applying to go to BUDS. Well, let's say 1,000 apply for one class, only about a couple hundred or 250 will start with that class. And then only a, you know, small percentage of those will actually graduate. So if you look at from a big number perspective, it's very high attrition rate.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. In the world of successful partnerships, names like Procter & Gamble, Ben & Jerry, and supply and demand echo through business history. But when it comes to growing your business, who are the perfect partners? That's you and Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. We're talking from launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to did we hit $1 million order stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Picture this, a time when my business was facing a tough hurdle and I wasn't sure how to break through. But then came the breakthrough moment, a game changer that took my business to the next level. You know, what I absolutely adore about Shopify is its unparalleled ability to adapt and grow with your ambitions. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 75 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Darius, all lowercase. That's D-A-R-I-U-S. Go to shopify.com/Darius now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Darius. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with the samples. Hey there, friends. It's Darius Mashazda here, and I have a little confession to make. You see, I've been battling allergies for years now, and let me tell you, they've been a real ordeal in my life. Allergies have been my constant companion. They stop me from fully enjoying the little things in life, canceling plans with friends because of sudden allergy attack, to missing out on an outdoor activity because of sneezing fits. Allergies have been a real nuisance. Luckily, for those of us who live with symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing and a runny nose, itchy, watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. I've been a Claritin D user for many, many years now, and let me tell you, it's made a world of difference. Since I started using Claritin D, my symptoms have improved dramatically. Now, I can breathe easier, enjoy outdoor activities without worrying about sneezing fits, and truly live my life without being held back by allergies. Ready to live as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter now. You don't even need a prescription. Go to ClaritinD.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear, use as directed.
Yeah, that's insane. And so what do you, so I mean, and I've heard things where people said, look, there's like Olympians in there that are quitting, right? So this is not about physical ability. I mean, there's obviously a component of physical ability. You need to meet that bar, but like 99% of this is like mental, ability.
It's a fascinatingly level playing field. I mean, it doesn't matter if you are a college track star or an Olympic swimmer, or, you know, we've got guys sometimes who've never seen the ocean before and they show up at Bucks and are successful or never been a competitive swimmer. And yet they're towards the head of the pack in these 2 mile ocean swims because they learned to kick the fins properly. You know, it's just one of those things when it comes down to, I mean, granted, I will say you absolutely have to show up in peak physical condition. You have to have trained. And we have more resources now than ever, from books to, you know, online resources to, they have pre-buds now where these guys will go from literally from boot camp to a strength training program there in Great Lakes, and then they'll go to buds. So they're very well prepared, but we still graduate about the same amount each class.
Right.
Yeah, because we've actually, being at war for 20 years, we've been trying to tweak the model to see, you know, what can we do? Think about it as a sales funnel. That's always my analogy.
Yeah, yeah.
Close more deals. We need to graduate more guys and get them into the teams. Yet, so we need better leads in the top of the funnel. Right. And we have to do that. One of the things we've done, and this was obviously, as you can imagine, a big conversation within the NSW community, as far as, do we lift that veil of secrecy? Do we let people know more about our community and who we are and what we actually do? And ultimately the answer was, there was some grumbling involved, but the answer was, well, we have to. You know, we have to showcase who we are as an organization so we can improve our talent acquisition strategies and we can get more really, really great guys into the program and then hopefully graduate larger classes. So that's why, you know, movies like Act of Valor, and there was, you know, there were active duty SEALs in that movie, and and DOD, you know, allowing more books and movies and things like that, so that, you know, these young folks can understand who we are as a community and be well prepared when they show up.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? It's one of those things where I could see both sides of it, which is one side's that, hey, this is kind of a secret force. We don't want our, and if it's public information, then people that maybe could use it against, you know, to try to defend against it. But then the other side of that's like, yeah, there's a 15% graduation rate for a reason, you know, because this is gnarly.
Well, and that's just the beginning. I mean, you people think that SEALs are just always downrange taking the fight to the enemy, but we spend 90% of our time training, like constantly training in a constant state of professional and personal development. And the other small percentage of time actually going out and operating and doing missions and things like that. So it's, the job is it's, people are like, oh, buds and Hell Week and all that stuff. That sucks. Yeah, yeah. The job itself is harder.
So when you finished, what did you specialize in? What part of the SEAL? I know you get a job, but what was your job?
Well, it's, you don't necessarily have certain specialties. It depends on what schools you apply for and what schools you know, sometimes it's first come, first serve, or you want to go to breacher school, or you want to go to sniper school, or these really cool off-road driving schools. It just kind of depends on what schools you get each platoon cycle. So we have a long period of pro dev or professional development. That's one of the things that, you know, my company, we're a leadership and organizational development consulting firm. And one of the points we make to our clients is look at the highest performing organizations out there, whether it's business, sports, military, whatever, constant training. And therefore, they're investing a lot of time and resources and money in developing their talent. Right. So that's really what you spend the majority of your time doing, is in professional development, going to all these different schools. So I've gone from everything from language schools to, you know, how to fix a boat motor to a Humvee to breaching to, you know, to everything you could possibly imagine. So
how long were you in the military for? When did you leave?
I got out in 06. Okay. So I wasn't in that long. And it's, I had some, we won't dive down that rabbit hole, but I had some family matters that required unfortunately, my full attention at the time. But it's kind of interesting in hindsight, looking back, you know, we're all like, well, these conflicts can't possibly go on, you know, for very long, because historically, you know, things, you know, like the Gulf War and things like that, you know, ended quickly. And here we are 20 years at war. So I, you know, figured I would get in and then see if I wanted to do it as a career and leave that open to a decision at that time. But, you know, I moved on and went to grad school and then dove headfirst into the world of entrepreneurship, which has about a similar failure rate.
So yeah.
On the lines, I developed a taste for calculated risk.
Yeah. And it's funny when you say that, when you start to look at the numbers around entrepreneurial success at certain levels, right? To build $1 million business versus a $10 million business versus a $100 million business, you know, the failure is imminent, right? More or less. Right. It's very rare that you see businesses that make it even past 5 years, right? So to your point, when you go look at these companies, though, are they doing are they doing business as usual, which is just like basically reacting, or are they actually being proactive and doing the type of stuff you're talking about?
That's always been, you know, something that I've found to be somewhat curious is, you know, you're always going to have, I call them micro failures. There are obstacles, roadblocks, whatever they're going to be. You know, my first business was a real estate, you know, home search engine, like a Trulia, Zillow type thing. And we built that. We raised a couple $1 million and built it up real quick right before the housing market imploded.
Yeah.
But my point is, there's, not to overuse this term because we've all been using it a lot over the past 14 months, but, you know, there's pivoting, there's adapting, there's taking key learnings and saying, what other revenue streams can we create from this? What other possible business opportunities can we create from this? Do we tweak this whole business model altogether? Do we throw it out and start new? I've found it challenging to understand when entrepreneurs or business leaders get to a point where they just literally have to close the door, you know, where they have, you know, obviously no cash reserves, not enough capital, or they're burning too lean for whatever reason, where they hit a wall so quickly that they literally just have to shut the doors. Mm-hmm. Luckily, you know, I've been blessed and have not had to be in those situations, but to that point, you know, very challenging situations like COVID. I run a leadership development company that involves a lot of speaking, a lot of in-person training. That all went away.
Right.
So we're like, oh, here we are again in a situation. But again, a lot of organizations out there, as you've seen, are coming out of this a lot more resilient. Sometimes some are more profitable. Some have recapitalized their entire organizations. They've rethought, you know, their talent needs, their office space needs, you know, how they approach their workforce, how they engage with their customers. So, you know, adversity breeds innovation. And so that's just the way that entrepreneurs need to think about it, is not just say, well, we'll cross that bridge when we get there, but expect it to happen. So be ready.
Totally. Yeah. I call it the 1 inch away from the nose mentality. You wait till your nose hits the wall, or you're going to try to get ready for it 100 yards away. Right. And so, you don't know this about me, but I'm a hardcore entrepreneur. You know, I built a couple 9-figure companies from the ground up, and I've had, businesses fully implode. My first business was number 40 in the Inc. 500. Yeah. And 40 fastest growing company in the United States. And when I was at that, when I was at the Inc. 5000, or it was 5000 then, yeah, Inc. 5000 conference to get my award.
Maybe we were there together. I don't know.
It was in September of 07.
Yeah.
I was there. And when that happened, I was literally laying off 90% of my staff and then went out of business 2 years later because I was a subprime mortgage lender, which wasn't a good place to be, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, to your point, you live and learn, but so you got, so that's pretty cool. So you get, so you got out of the military and then you ended up in the world of entrepreneurship. And obviously since then have written books. So tell us, tell us about the businesses and, you know, yeah. What was your first entrepreneurial business and how did that lead to where you're at right now?
Entrepreneurship, similar to the military, was not actually part of the plan. My transition strategy was graduate school. So going back to school, having that time to network, learn some new things, retrain my brain towards business. And, you know, with the thought that I'd possibly get back into the world of finance or possibly real estate development, that was kind of more of the route I was originally envisioning. And, you know, the story is very cliche. I met my former business partner in grad school and one of our projects for our finance class turned into the foundation of our first, the business plan for our first company, which was a home finding search engine. So we wanted to find some, there wasn't the level of technology like the Zillows and Trulias, those came out shortly thereafter. So there was, you know, some white space there that we'd capitalize on, the non-bubble of the housing market. We're like, this is genius. What could possibly go wrong? And our even I remember one of our economics professors was like, guys, and she was an academic, so like, you know, she's talking about
what do you know?
You're doing this, you know. And, yeah, she was right. And you know, it took off. Obviously, not because of our entrepreneurial genius, but because people were throwing any and all marketing dollars at lead generation for selling homes, and because they. You know, their homes are just flying off the shelf and home prices keep going up or kind of in a weird position like that. Seems like,
yeah,
right now.
I'm like, sounds like now.
Feels very familiar.
I've seen this movie before.
Yeah.
I will say this though, the financing around these houses is different this time. Because that was a really, and I mean, I will truly say that I don't think it'll end the same way unless you have a huge change in work in people's employment. That would be the one thing that I could see it changing. But anyway,
I 100% agree with you. So what we did, kind of going back to what we were talking about before, is like a radical pivot was, you know, we didn't just walk away from that business when, you know, 08 into 09, as you recall. It's, yeah, things were bad, but, you know, it didn't just implode, you know, automatically. We you know, kept running it, kept trying to get creative with the revenue streams. And one of the things we did is we had learned so much about digital media, analytics, digital marketing, just to run that business and drive traffic to the site and search engine optimization and paid media, things like that, that, you know, we thought, you know, well, maybe there's an opportunity, in the digital marketing space. And originally it was going to be an alternative revenue stream because some of our clients were home builders or real estate marketing agencies. So we're saying, well, can you guys build us a website as well? Or do you guys do social media strategy? Or what are things do you guys do, if anything? And so we decided the answer, like all entrepreneurs, we're like,
yes,
absolutely. Yeah. We do that. All right, go find a outsource partner.
What else do we do? It all.
Hot air balloon? We can't give you a hot air balloon.
We'll watch your dog.
Hell yeah, we do all that. And you know the drill. And so what was going to just be an alternative revenue stream to that business took off. So what we did was we kept it internal at first within the same legal entity. And then we were like, you know what, this is a business all by itself and it needs to be approached as a business all by itself. So we borrowed, step one was borrow $100,000 from this business, start a new legal entity and a whole new brand and a new company. We gave those shareholders, you know, our investors in that first business, equal common stock shares in the new company. Mm-hmm. And so, because, you know, we're essentially using their money or that money to start a new business. So deemed somewhat of a legal, you know, or corporate opportunity. And so, and it was the right thing to do anyway. So that business slowed. We started to shift a lot of our attention to this new business, but it kept, you know, running for years. And the other one just took off. I mean, we were tripling in size, both in revenue and headcount every year. At a certain degree, growing maybe a little too fast, but we had really a good board of directors, good advisors that helped us kind of navigate intelligent growth as opposed to just grow for the sake of growing. And I sold that business in August 2016. So we had a good run, and it there was an opportunity for an exit there. It full transparency, it wasn't the exit we had originally anticipated. Like all entrepreneurs, this, you know, 10x crazy type of situation, but it was a healthy exit. It was great for the business. It was great for the employees. It was great for the acquisition partner. And also my business partner and I had kind of started to, grow apart as business partners and, marriages of all kinds do, and just very different leadership and management styles, but also just a pretty vast difference in vision of where to take the business. And if the two senior people have a vastly different vision of where to take the business, it's going to stop. And it won't fail necessarily, but you're not going to get to the next level.
Of course.
So it was time to do that exit. And I had some other passions and opportunities and things that I really wanted to pursue. So the timing was good.
Oh man. I love those stories because, what's funny is when you get in entrepreneurship, you kind of assume that ending. To your point, there's that we're going to be rich. I'm going to be flying on private jets and it's going to be like Mark Zuckerberg, but then the people forget the 10-year part. What about the decade of getting crushed? And you have highs and lows, but it's hard, what you just did. Like, most people don't do that.
I thought entrepreneurs build their business and exit in 5 years and then do it again and again.
Yeah.
Very cliche. And we also usually, there are those stories, but that's usually not what happens.
Yeah. It's to your point. And I just exited my company about a year ago and it was, I'm like, you just told me my story to myself, right? Which is, it wasn't what I thought it would be, but it's good enough. And then you're transitioning, which is its own thing. It's interesting. So I want to hear about the transition. So now is this now Brent 2.0 where you're doing the leadership work?
Yeah. So one of the things, and I'm sure you share a similar interest in being a successful entrepreneur, is one of the things I found a passion for wasn't necessarily the industries that those businesses were in, but of building something great, of building a great culture, having a great vision, great people practices, and developing awesome talent and highly engaged people doing cool stuff and happy customers getting cool stuff because of the great people doing awesome work. And so leadership and culture and engagement strategies and finding ways to build, my own version of high performing teams and drawing from some of the, leadership, culture, and behavior principles that forged the world of elite special operations, and saying, what can we draw from those fundamental principles in building high functioning teams and organizations out here in the business world that deliver desired results and business outcomes. And so my next transition strategy was, step one was to actually write my first book, Taking Point. And, like some authors do kind of in the space, the book was meant to be the foundation of many of our leadership and organizational transformation principles and fundamentals. So, and it was a good exercise for me to really take the time to do the research and study. It was like writing a 300-page dissertation on change management. And take, more of like the Navy SEAL version of John Cotter, like special operations mixed with, leading change principles, and, drawing from many of the mistakes that I had made and some of the small successes that I'd had, or mainly the things that I learned in building the first two companies, and saying, what can we build here? And so that book, Taking Point, was the foundation of my company now, which is Taking Point Leadership. So we're, full service leadership, organizational development, consulting firm. So.
And so you guys right now, you're working with companies that are essentially your clients come to you. You're working with the leadership teams, the C-level. Kind of walk us through what does a typical client engagement look like?
A typical client engagement for us, we work typically with, your medium. I know medium-sized business is a vast, arena, but medium to enterprise-level organizations. So our ideal clients are either clients who have now finally realized that they need to do a better job of developing their talent and their people practices and building leaders at every level in their organization. So they're either right at the beginning of their journey, but they've fully committed that they're going to invest the time, resources, and money into being a training organization, so to speak. Yeah. Or we partner with organizations that, have been doing that for years, or they use, different types of strategic partners like us. And so they get it, they invest in it already, they continue to grow. And bring in new talent, or they're bringing talent and leaders and managers up throughout the ranks. So they need training. So sometimes our our engagements will start with something as simple as me being a keynote speaker at an event, and that turns into something more. You know, so it's, you know, multi-month, multi-year development programs for. We do encourage them to involve C-level in these larger programs, but typically we're engaging with the mid-layer of managers because, you know, as you know, they're touching the vast majority of the organization, as opposed to just developing leaders up here at the top or in one business unit over here. We might work, obviously, with, you know, we're working with this cohort of sales leaders, then we're working with research and development, or now we're working with the ops team. So obviously we're not always doing the training with everybody all at the same time, and usually working with, you know, 15 to 20 size, you know, person cohorts that are going through that training. But organizations who want to create alignment when it comes to leadership, they want to create behavioral norms. They want to have, a common thread when it comes to language and how they communicate and what their, you know, what their culture looks like and how to integrate all that into building better leaders. And they're, looking at their high potential leaders and managers in the organization and having some type of ongoing program that they'll always bring their people through.
And so I'm gonna selfishly ask you a question right now. So I wrote a book called The Core Value Equation, which the premise of the book is that core values have the opportunity to become the language of the organization, and that core values are the fundamental beliefs of an organization. What are your thoughts on that?
Couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I write a lot about core values in my first book, and I wrote them in my second book too, when it relates to individual core values or your family core values.
Yeah.
To your point, they really ideally, in a high-performing organization, the core values are authentic. They're talked about all the time. They're used from everything from attracting and acquiring great talent to onboarding to training to the decisions we make to how we lead and engage our team to the customers and clients we engage with.
Totally.
I'm sure you've seen that. There's a good question is, and I bet I know your answer is probably the same as mine, is anytime I've ever engaged with a client or customer in any of my businesses that did not share similar values, or the purpose behind the relationship was inauthentic, those relationships never last, and they end up costing you money. Their budget is really big, but they're a bunch of assholes, but let's engage with them anyway because they have a huge budget. Well, the relationship's going to last 3 months. They eat away at your utilization and your emotion and your time, and therefore you realize, oh shit, we just lost a ton of money.
Totally.
And core values are. And it's funny, it's a good question because, you know, most organizational leaders are 100% like, oh yeah, core values, got them.
We got them. What are they?
They're on the wall in the conference room, remember?
Yeah.
And nobody in the organization can articulate what they are. The leaders themselves can't really explain how those core values drive every aspect of the business, or how they even drive their financial outcomes or their results that they're trying to achieve.
Right.
So we check the box, but hey, we have the core values, but they don't get ingrained into anything the organization does.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I do this activity with people where and this happened to me. I did this entrepreneur leadership program through EO called called Birthing of Giants.
Yes.
And I graduated in 08 from it. And the last day of our class, we did a peer to peer workshop, and they said, stand up if your company has core values. Everyone stands up. Mind you, this is a scaling up. Was the Vern Harnish was this is his program? So yeah. I don't know if you know Vern, but yeah. Then they go, please stay standing if you say your core values off the top of your head. Half the room sits down, and I was in that half. And then they said, please stay. And we're all the CEOs of the companies, like we're the ones that created them. Please stay standing if your employees know the core values. Half the remaining half sits down.
Yeah.
Please stay standing if your customers know your core values. Everyone's sitting down.
Yeah.
And for me, that was a pivotal moment in my life. It made me realize that this is kind of weird. You know, this is such an important thing. Why would it not be, to your point, all the things you're describing, that's what you want to create. But it's a bit of a black box, because I think, to your point, people say they have them, and then intuitively they know that it's important, so they do it kind of passively, but they're not intentional about it. They're not training to it. They're not working with someone like you and your team to build it so where it becomes the language of the organization.
Yeah.
And
it's good to even, like, we're even doing this, you know, in our next team strategy planning day, we're even going to go back and revisit our mission, vision, and value statements to see, you know, are these still authentic? Are they really driving what we're trying to do? And if the answer is yes, these are still authentic, this sounds right. Okay, well, maybe we need to tweak some things as far as, you know, the what of where we spend our time, the activities we're engaging in, how we think about short and long-term goals for the organization. you know, assuming that these values are authentic, they still really speak to who we are as an organization and who we want to become. Because people think, well, values, can't ever change the values. Well, I mean, sometimes as an organization evolves, we do need to go back and revisit the mission or the values, or also depending upon how and when they were created and by who.
Right. Yeah.
By one person, by themselves, with no, you know, no input from anybody else. Sometimes that, you know, that was just checking the box and doesn't really drive what the organization is all about.
Yeah, they'll age out a little bit, right? Because the if core values, I have a buddy who's a performance coach, his name's Robert Ellis, and he says core values are the essence of the organization, and Vern says they're a personality of the organization. So if you did them in a vacuum by yourself, you know, like, yeah, and now you got 30 employees or 10 employees or whatever, that, you know, you have a bunch of different personalities that weren't there before, and how much input do they have, right? Yeah. How much are they driving the culture of the business? So yeah, I fully agree with you. I used to say they could never change, but I kind of since
changed. Well, I used to say the same thing too. Like that was a fundamental, like you learn values are the values, you can't change the values. Well, or you can at least change the narrative around what those values mean to the organization as it grows, as it evolves. That's one thing that we take our clients through is like, okay, you have your core values. Great. Well, let's take it two layers deeper. You know, if let's say one of your core values is integrity, just use some simple cliche core value. What are the supporting behaviors that we can clearly define and articulate as they relate to how we think about integrity in this organization? How do we measure it? You know, anything important, as you know, has got to be managed and measured, even a core value. So what are those specific behaviors we expect of ourselves and others that we can measure and that we can reward and that we can make sure we don't tolerate anything outside of that realm? And then the third layer is, great, okay, what are the accountability mechanisms? How are we going to ensure that we're holding ourselves and each other to these supporting behaviors to ensure that integrity is an authentic core value in the organization? So really getting like granular and specific with it. I'm sure you probably talk about that in the book, which I'm definitely going to buy because I love that stuff.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting. And I mean, I'm so bummed we're out of time. I wanted to talk to you more about this stuff, but maybe we'll have to do a 2.0. So, you know, I think that it's, to your point, is you're taking something that is intangible and you're making it tangible.
Yep.
And you're saying, hey, if this was anything else in your business, you would be doing these things. You're creating KPIs around it. You're right. You get what you tolerate. You're measuring things that are important to you. You're doing things to produce value in the business, right? Yeah. What is your return on the investment of into this? I call it a cultural asset.
Yeah.
You know? And so I love everything. I mean, I'm like, yes, we agree on everything.
I knew we did.
Brent, you are smart, man. I don't know. You're one smart dude.
Trying to be more like you, bro.
Well, man, look, I know we're out of time here, but you know, I really do mean it. I would love for us to maybe do a 2.0 if you're up for it.
Absolutely.
And we can, and maybe we'll try to square away more time, as I really want to dive more into the work you guys are doing. And I think that, you know, given your military background, I'd love to kind of see how those two worlds have collided and how that influences work. Cause I'll tell you this, you know, I work with high growth companies. And a lot of the times I'll ask, when I ask their teams the question, have you ever worked at a company that had core values before? A lot of people raise their hands. And then I'll say, can any of you recite what they are? The only people that can are people that when they're referring to the military and they're referring to remembering the military, the values they learned in the military. Yeah. And I'm like, that is an example of an organization that understands this. And why? Because lives are at stake with them. Like if I screw up your hamburger at my restaurant, it's not like the end result's not necessarily as dire, right? So I think that kind of points to that's a conversation for another time,
it's one quick thing on that. So we have the, you know, in the SEAL teams, we have the Navy SEAL ethos. It's kind of like our mission, vision, values, culture manifesto, all wrapped up into a nice, beautiful one page, you know, five paragraphs, whatever, what have you. But you think, well, SEAL teams were commissioned back in the early 60s. So obviously we launched right into who we are with the Navy SEAL ethos. We didn't create the SEAL ethos until 2005.
Really?
Well, yeah. And the interesting thing is we, you know, post 9/11, we'd been moving at the speed of war for 4 years and realized the powers that be realized like, we don't really have anything at all other than a few catchphrases here and there that you see on the wall of a couple bars in Coronado. We don't have anything that documents who we are as an organization, who we want to bring into our organization, how we measure our behavior and the way we think, the way we lead, the way we behave on the battlefield. And so it was very corporate thing. They did a leadership offsite event at San Clemente Island with, a cross section of NSW leaders. And that's where the SEAL ethos came from. And it really does drive and clearly define not just the values and the culture, but, you know, how we measure it and how we can point, like to you said, very in a very tangible way, these are the very specific behaviors we expect of each other.
Oh, man. I love it. I want to, if I Google that, will that, can I find that online?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh. It's really powerful. Now again, as we build our own multi-generational workforce in the SEAL teams, some of the younger generations have now they're saying, well, I don't really connect with that. It's too long or it's too much. Or so you can't please everybody, Darius. But
screw the young kids. The millennials can go pound sand.
Well, newsflash, we have millennials in the SEAL teams now.
Yeah. I know. That's what they can
go. It was bound to happen.
Gen Y, you can go pound sand too. Yeah. Brent, this is so fun, man. I'd love for you to maybe like give us where can people find you? Just give us the lowdown. We're going to put it all in the show notes and we'll get this wrapped up.
Cool, man. Yeah. Our company website's takingpointleadership.com. You can check out the new book, obviously on any online retailers and brick and mortar retailers. Amazon is obviously a great place to find it. Again, the title is Embrace the Suck, The Navy SEAL Way to an Extraordinary Life. And it's got a great gut punch of a foreword by my friend and former teammate, David Goggins, whom I'm sure many of your viewers and listeners know who he is. So
nice. Yeah, no, Goggins, his scribe was his publisher for his book. So his book that came out. So, and I did my book through those guys, but yeah, Goggins is, I haven't read his book, but I've heard good things about it. And that's awesome that he's supporting your book. Brent, man, 40 minutes flew by faster than it should have. Yeah. That was amazing. I'm serious. I'd love to have you back for 2.0. We'll go deeper on the book and the work you're doing. Guys, what a treat. Brent just like dropping knowledge and, you know, changing the world in such an amazing way through entrepreneurship, through the military, and now through his leadership work. And so grateful to have you here, my friend, and looking forward to next time.
Can't wait, brother. Talk all soon, right, man.
Peace out.
Yeah.
You are listening to The Greatness Machine, and that's a wrap for today. Listen, if you love what you heard, subscribe to the show on whatever podcast platform that you're tuning in on, so that you don't miss any of our future episodes. We have tons of great people coming on and we're stoked to have you here to enjoy it with us. Leave us a review. Tell us what you love most about this particular episode. We love getting the reviews. We love to see what you guys love most. And if this particular episode, you know, made you think of someone who's leveling up in their business and in their life, print screen, share it with them. Leaders are the best givers. And after all, we're all here to support and grow with each other. And in case you want to see some of the fun behind the scenes shots or some of the things that we're doing, I'm actually writing about this in my weekly newsletter. Go to www.therealdarius.com and subscribe to my newsletter. We're talking about fun things like business and life and mindfulness and cryptocurrencies and gosh, I don't even know, everything and anything, but it's tons of fun stuff I write about. I try to get it out on a weekly basis. You can subscribe at www.therealdarius.com. And with that said, look, thank you guys so much. Appreciate you. I love you. Peace. We're out of here. See you guys on the next one. She's my lover.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.